Certainly, just one matter. I have with me Ms. Barnett, and so I just wanted to record her appearance. Initials SFD.
How many T's, Ms. Barnett?
Two.
There we go.
Thank you, Your Honour.
Thank you. I'll just check in quickly before we go to cross-examination. Parties should have received the list that I referred to last night. Mr. Conway, rough order of timing for getting that information together or some of it together, what do you think?
Sir, I've passed it on to Dr. Southbrook to coordinate, and it's been helpful. Information from Federated Farmers, that one of its team is also looking into that information. I don't yet have a time frame.
No, so that's fine.
I've asked for that time frame as a first step, so we'll endeavour to provide that as soon as we can.
Well, it's more important that I think we get a schedule of information that everybody says reflects what is in the evidence or is otherwise available. I don't think it's desperately urgent in that regard, so take that time. Just while you're on your feet, we've got a supplementary statement from Dr. Scarsbrook with the additional information that Commissioner Hodges was asking about and some very helpful diagrams. Now, I've only glanced at it. The question I suppose I have that you might just pass back to Dr. Scarsbrook, and he could answer either through you or possibly with a further small supplementary statement. It's quite obvious that the levels in the Waipa are higher, as shown here, than in the Waikato. What isn't clear is whether that reflects either a greater amount of contaminants going into the Waipa compared to the Waikato, or simply that the Waikato is so much bigger that the levels diluted further. And it may well be, because this is all based on grams per cubic metre, it's the former rather than the latter, it should be relatively clear. But if Dr. Scarsbrook were able to just offer a view about that, given that we're dealing with two separate river systems.
Yes, we'll inquire. And I should note on that, that level, given that next week we will be sitting in Hamilton, and we'll also have Ms. May, Monday morning or thereabouts, maybe if there's any other questions while we're still on the council's witnesses, Dr. Scarsbrook could pop back in or even to confirm that evidence, but we'll ask him that question as the first step.
Thank you. Your Honour, sorry, could I just clarify something with that list? Sorry, Mr. Conway. I didn't put in there about including the land costs in the list, but that obviously needs to be in the cost list.
So by that you mean the opportunity cost in terms of the land that will no longer be able to be farmed?
Correct, yeah. I didn't specifically mention that. And the other one was, I wondered whether there would need to be different types of fencing for a small wetland compared to springs. That's something I think the parties need to consider. And it would be really good if everyone can agree the brief for the studies. So that is on the set that we actually get everybody's concerns covered by at least the economic side of things, and then just leave us with the easy part of sorting out the technical values of different ecological measures to mitigate different
things. Yes, absolutely. Thanks, Commissioner.
Thank you.
If I may, just in terms of the list of issues,
I've also been liaising with the Director General's experts.
Yes.
They too have some comments.
Good.
So I'll liaise with Mr. Conway so that you have one set.
That would be helpful. And of course, if there are differences in views, there's nothing to stop the list recognising that there are different views in relation to that.
Thank you, sir.
Right, now I think we got to Ms. Carruthers for Wairaki Pastoral and questioning. Right. And is, or Ms. Carruthers, are you expecting to go next?
I was, yes, unless Ms. Forrest's in court.
I don't.
I can see she's not online.
No.
Well, she wasn't.
She's not with us this morning. So we'll press ahead with you. We'll see whether or not she comes along. Now, Council, I'm just going to inquire, as I have done with previous witnesses, whether this witness remains on his former oath. Is there any objection? Mr. Trevilco, you may have heard this in relation to other witnesses. I'm asking you to recall the oath that you made yesterday to tell the truth. You recall that oath?
Yes, sir.
You remain on that oath,
yes,
giving evidence today. Thank you very much. Thank you, Ms. Carruthers.
Thank you, sir. And just as a matter of brief housekeeping before I start, I was hoping that the courier delivery coming to the house was going to be here by now, but it's not, which means that the pack of dogs that are through that door may make quite a noise at some point during my questioning. Now, you may not be able to hear it, but if that happens, I'm not going to be able to hear anything for 30 seconds or so. So if there's a weird pause, that's likely what happened to mine.
Well, thank you for warning us of that.
Some unexplained lengthy pause is probably because I can't hear a thing. But
all right.
Hopefully that won't have a line questioning. So I'm not sure what activates the camera to swing around to Mr. Trevilco, but hopefully as he starts speaking, it will... Oh, look at that. There we go. Thank you very much.
I think Ms. Kim is able to control it to a degree, so I think you've done that, have you? Yes, so there we are.
Yes, she has.
Stay on with us. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm going to start with some of the matters that other witnesses this week kicked to touch for you to address when it was your turn. And firstly, the alignment between Plan Change 1 Farm Environment Plans and the more recent regulations. You may recall when Mr. Sinclair was giving evidence that it was clear that he saw options either to delete the farm plan provisions from PC1 or to retain them in a modified form, and he didn't express a preference for which of those options and indicated that he'd left it to you to decide. Is that correct?
Yes, I don't remember all the details, but accept that. Thank you.
Right. And so can I check then, was it you that made the decision to retain it or a council decision to retain the farm plan provisions in PC1?
I made the decision in consultation with some of the implementation team.
Could I just ask anyone who is online, please mute your microphone and see if we can avoid any feedback. Thank you. So, Mr. Trevilco, you're saying you made that decision?
In consultation with other staff, yes.
And those were staff in the implementation team?
That's right.
Right. And so, Mr. Sinclair also informed the court that the regulations mirror what Plan Change 1 was trying to do, but there may be particular things that Plan Change 1 could add to reflect to Te Ture Pai Mana. Is that your view as well?
Yes, that's right. And I think when he was talking about mirroring, he was talking at a very high level. It was really the fact that we have been putting the Farm Environment Plan provisions into PC1 for some time, and it may have been, our government may have been influenced in some of their thinking about farm environment plans when they set up the regulations. I think that's what he was thinking at a high level.
Right. But but it's him and his evidence that does that fine-grained analysis of the similarities and differences between the Planting One farm plans and the regulation farm plans.
That would be more Mr. Smith's evidence to do the fine-grained.
I think. Yes, of course. That's quite true. Okay. Do you accept that without the Plan Change 1 farm plans, we may not get as far ahead, but we're not going backwards?
I need to answer. I don't think there's a yes-no on that. The way I would answer that, I think it was Mr. Smith who said the regulations come from it from one end and the PC1 provisions from the other.
Mm-hmm.
The way I would explain that is to say that the regulations provide a process for farm environment plans. The PC1 provided a very vague process through its provisions, but more importantly, it provided outcomes for the farm environment process. So it gave very strong guidance on the minimum standards to be achieved through farm environment plans and the goals and principles to be achieved through farm environment plans. So the freshwater regulations for farm plans don't do that. They just provide a process to develop them, and at a high level, that's about identifying the adverse effects from farm activities on water and addressing, mitigating those effects. So it does kind of say that at a high level, but it's the importance of PC1 are the additional expectations of what's to be achieved through the farm plans. So, and I guess that explains at a high level the changes that I am recommending to schedules D1 and D2 in particular, to actually take out some of those process provisions about certification and auditing, so that we don't have conflicting process requirements in PC1 conflicting with the regulations, but retaining the bigger picture, where do we want to go in terms of purpose statements, and what outcomes do we want to achieve by that. And as well as retaining some of the information requirements that aren't in the regulations and are specific to PC1, for example, things like which subcatchment is the farm and that kind of thing.
So you're aware that under the regulations, the farm plan must identify the risks of adverse effects of farming activities on fresh water, and then identify actions to avoid, remedy, or mitigate those risks.
That's right. And that's
so that's not just process.
Well, no, that's what I was saying. There is a high-level kind of outcome statement there, in the sense it's process,
mm-hmm.
but yes, there is some high-level stuff, but they're not the same as minimum farming standards and principles and goals, getting down to a more detailed level of what we're trying to achieve. But I agree with you, yes. And those directions are quite consistent, I think, with the policy directions, the policy four directions in PC1.
Yeah, so my question to you was, do you accept that without the Plan Change 1 farm plans in place, we may not get as far ahead, but we're not going to be going backwards?
Yeah, probably, given that conversation, I think it's fair.
Right. And so you, in consultation with members of the implementation team, have decided to retain the Plan Change 1 farm plan provisions, with Section 293 needed to align them with the regulations.
That's right.
Can I check whether you considered the alternative of withdrawing the Plan Change 1 farm plan provisions?
I didn't seriously consider that, no, for the reasons that I've explained, that there are really important requirements for farm plans in PC1 that I wouldn't like to see disappear.
Okay. And so you would rather the court and the parties needed to use section 293 and potentially delay plan change 1 being made up from it?
Yes. I don't know what the time frame may be. I think one of the judges or the commissioners suggested that it may be 6 months if we do a 293 process to get to a full decision on PC1. I think that may be workable, and we've been kind of expecting it's going to be April so next year anyway. That's only just workable in terms of the threshold of policy review and being able to use a decision on PC1 on that process. I mean, we're still going to be putting as much as we know of PC1 into that plan anyway, but it'd be really great to have a decision before we notify that plan change.
Okay. I'd like to then move to Rule 311.49, the non-complying activity rule, and this is another one that Mr. Sinclair passed the buck to you on.
Yep.
He was very clear that this is a hold the line rule, but was unclear on what any consent issued under it authorised. And I know that you provided some explanation yesterday before you started cross-examination, I'll get to that. But in terms of the hold the line nature of the rule,
yes.
Do you accept that since the National Environmental Standard Freshwater came out, that document also holds the line?
I think, first of all, I wouldn't actually describe Rule 3149 as a hold the line rule.
Okay.
No. And I don't think that 3149, along with the rest of PC1, is as stringent as the regulations, the NES regulations. Mm-hmm. And therefore, if it is hold the line, I think one is going to hold it more strongly than the other. But I don't really see these as hold the line rules.
Okay, that's helpful. So if we then turn to what the rule authorises, and aware of the structure of Plan Change 1 generally, so Rules 311.41 through to 311.48. So all of the other rules are hybrid rules, both land use and discharge. That's correct, isn't it?
That's right.
And 311.49 is just a land use consent.
Yes.
And that was a clear and deliberate decision by council right through the Section 32 analysis and the decision.
I don't really know that. I haven't seen sort of detailed discussion about why that was only a land use rule. I'm kind of conjecturing that it's because of the rule, the role that that rule has in authorising land use change as opposed to discharges.
Okay. And so it's obvious as a non-complying activity rule that in order to obtain consent under this rule, you'd have to meet one of the gateways. But I'm curious in terms of consent granted under this rule, what is actually authorised?
Yes.
So we're clear that discharges aren't authorised.
That's right.
In terms of the use that you're moving to, I understood you to say yesterday that you would then need a consent under one of the other Plan Change 1 rules in order to farm the land. Did I hear you correctly?
You would need either a consent or to meet one of the permitted activity rules.
I see. And so, if you obtained consent under this rule, all you're authorised to do is apply for a new consent to farm or fit within the permitted rules.
My understanding is all you're authorised to do is a land use change. Exactly what, you know, using the wording that it says. So you are authorised to either change the use of land to commercial vegetable production, or from woody vegetation to farming, or from land use to dairy farming. That's all it's authorising, in my view.
Right. But in terms of that change, though, if it's not authorising the new thing to happen, is it authorising you to stop doing the old thing?
I don't know if that's the case. It might be an interpretation, perhaps, because you're not really authorising to stop doing the old thing. You're really authorising a new land use for that land. That's the way I read it. And you know, maybe that's the same as saying you're authorising to stop. You don't need a consent to stop land use anyway. It's just it's the new stuff that's been authorised.
Hmm. But if your new thing, say for example, is control or RD, depending on your risk level.
Yes.
A consent under this rule to change isn't allowing you to do the new activity, is it?
That's my understanding of it, yes. That's my reading of these rules.
Yeah. Okay. And Dr. Scarsbrook earlier in the week confirmed that his concern with conversion was the discharges. This rule, well, a consent under this rule isn't related to the discharges in any way, is it?
I think the discharges or the effects of the land use change will need to be taken into account in this rule. So you would need to take into account, I think, any effect of that land use change, which in my view would include potential discharges, in order to make a decision on that.
Right, and so that's the effects of allowing the change include the discharges. The logic we're using there.
Yeah, I would say so.
Okay. And then Dr. Scarsbrook was also most concerned about converting pine to dairy. The rule's currently much broader than that, isn't it?
Yes, I think he was referring to the State of Environment report and the deterioration in some water quality in some catchments following the conversion, the historic conversion of pine to dairy. I don't think he was necessarily saying that was his only concern.
I see. So turning then to the activity status, so the non-complying status, you address that in paragraph 381 of your evidence in chief and paragraphs 299 to 300 of your rebuttal. So in those three paragraphs of your evidence, it's very clear that you see non-complying activity status as a clear signal not to do the activity.
That's not how I would say it.
Right.
If you'd like me to explain, I just see that if an activity has significant potential to work against the achievement of the objectives, then it really needs to be tested in a very thorough way against those objectives. And therefore, in my view, the non-compliant rule is the appropriate rule.
Right. And as I read your evidence, that's because as a non-complying, you need to be not contrary to the objects and policies.
Yes.
Whereas for a discretionary activity, in your words, you just have regard to the planning provisions.
That's right.
Right.
I mean, I think that's part of the reason, but I think there is a beyond that still a requirement for more rigorously testing an application for an activity that may adversely affect the ability to achieve the objectives. So I think it is not just about the language of have regard to or not being consistent with policies. I think it's just the fact that if it's an activity that has more threat to the objectives, it needs a more rigorous assessment.
Right. And do you accept that more strongly worded objectives and policies can usefully drive outcomes at the consenting stage?
I think they can do.
Is your worry that the consents team won't?
Well, I think you're right that this, the difference of have regard to in terms of discretionary activities and not being consistent with the policies and objectives, that is, you do have a lot more flexibility to grant for a discretionary activity. So irrespective of how clear the objectives are, I'm saying.
And I can see from your experience in your evidence in chief that you did spend some time as a consents planner early in your career, but can I check that was almost 20 years ago, was it, since you've been consents planning?
Yes, I can't remember the dates, but yes, probably for the first 10 or 15 years, 10 years at least, of my career at Waikato Regional Councils, I was in the what was called at the time the resource use group, which was the consents monitoring enforcement area.
Okay. So, like you, Mr. Giraffo, I've only been involved in Plan Change 1 since the appeal stage, but I know that you are well familiar with the decision at the council level. I assume you're also very familiar with the Section 32 report that was done prior to the council hearing?
I have read it, and it's a long paper, and I don't have a good memory, so I can't say that I could quote it back to you.
Right. Okay, well, it's in the bundle. I'm not sure what colour they are, but the series starting with 501.
Yes, I think I've got a copy here, actually.
Okay, I'm going to be reading. The document that starts 501-1364. Not sure what tab number, sorry.
Sorry, I've taken it out. Could you repeat that, please?
501-1364.
501 part 1 in the brown back volumes. Part 1, and then it's under tab 16.
I mean, the relevant page is 1549, I think, is where the rule is discussed.
Yes, thank you.
My highlighting has disappeared overnight, which is not helpful, but on page 501-1550, somewhere, yes, under option 2. An interim measure makes it clear here that it was intended to be an interim measure with immediate effect. And in the fourth paragraph, the last sentence says the intent was for this protection from further degradation to be made from notification while still allowing public consultation and input on the rule through the Schedule 1 RMA process of submissions and hearings.
Yes.
This is a clear indication from the outset that it was expected there'd be input from parties through the submission and appeal process.
Yes.
And on the next page, made it clear that it wasn't intended to be a moratorium.
Can you point me to that?
That consents could be applied for. What was that, sorry?
Could you point me to where it says it's not a moratorium?
Yeah, hang on. Sorry, I had this highlighted, but it's disappeared.
Well, in the first paragraph on 1551, in the sixth line, despite this, the provisions do not prohibit land use change.
I'm sure the word appears somewhere on that page, but yes, it's not. It anticipates that consents could be applied for during that time frame.
Yes.
And then on the next page makes it clear that the intent is to manage discharges.
Sorry, where are you looking at now? Oh, that's under 1552, under the heading relevance, E4.5.1.
Yes.
The focus is to manage effects of diffuse discharges.
That's right.
You got that?
Yes, thank you.
Thank you.
That is, sorry, this is really frustrating that highlighting's all gone. And then if we, on the next page, under acceptability, the final sentence, it's not intended to remove the ability of landowners to operating existing activities on their land. It's not intended to have retrospective application. You accept that?
Sorry, could you just point to me again where you're reading?
Sorry, the final sentence of the first paragraph under 3453.
Oh, yes, thank you very much. Yes, it is. That's right, yes.
And so, as notified, this rule had a sunset date.
Yes.
Of 2026?
Yes, I think that's right. Yeah. Something like that.
Right. And the decision, which is at 501-1786,
that's in.
That deleted.
Sorry, you're looking at the decision of the commissioners now.
Yes, I am, and it's in the same bundle, I believe.
No,
there.
Well, it's in a separate physical volume.
Oh, sorry.
So you'll need to open the other brown folder.
I do have
got that
here. Yes.
So what page are we on, and if we could use or whichever.
In the decision?
Yes.
So of the decision, it's page 501-1813, paragraph 100.
This is paragraph 100 of the decision?
Yes.
That's right.
In paragraph 100, mine starts, we accept that the current understanding, etc. Is that the one you mean?
Right.
Oh,
yeah.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then the second sentence, because of this, PC1, as notified, sought to introduce controls to require better management and to halt further land use change until the policy and rule framework was in place.
Yes.
And monitoring results of the effectiveness of PC1 were known.
Yes.
While the sunset date was removed, the decision still intended this to be an interim rule. Is that your understanding?
Well, it was my understanding that they anticipated that this would have a 10-year term and that there will be further rules to changes to follow.
I
don't understand that this particular rule was considered an interim rule as opposed to the rest of PC1.
Okay, so your understanding is that this rule was intended to survive as long as Plan Change 1 survived?
That's my understanding, yes.
Okay. So, Wairaki Pastoral's appeal seeks to delete this rule or to update the date in the rule to the operative date for Plan Change 1.
Yes.
So the rule at the moment is changes in land use within a property where the change exceeds a cumulative net total of 4.1 hectares from that which was occurring at 22 October 2016.
Yes.
And it's that 22 October 2016 which the Wairaki appeal seeks to update to the date when Plan Change 1 was made operative to replace the new date in that rule. That's your understanding of the request?
Yes.
Okay. Now, you address that in your rebuttal evidence, paragraphs 101 to 104. Can I check whether you accept that it was lawful to apply for certificates of compliance prior to notification?
Yes.
And it was lawful for Wairaki to submit on the rule?
Yes.
And lawful for it to implement the certificates of compliance?
Yes.
And also lawful for it to appeal the rule?
Yes.
Now, Wairaki is well aware that if the rule survives, it will need to apply for consent. And everything it's done has been lawful. Do you feel that the tone of the language you've used in paragraphs 101 to 105 is fair?
As far as I'm aware, it is. I'm not aware of any part that's not fair.
Okay. Mr. Sinclair, yes, whatever day, losing track, day before yesterday, suggested that there might have been a bunch of COCs granted throughout the region. Are you aware how extensive that may be? Was it just Wairakei or are there other COCs for conversion?
I'm sorry, I don't know the answer to that.
So you're not aware if there are other farmers with certificates of compliance for conversion?
That's right.
Okay. Now, Mr. Sinclair wasn't aware of council taking action for any breaches of this rule. Are you aware of any?
No, not aware of any.
Okay. So if there's no known breaches of this rule, and Wairakei's conversion post-2016 is lawful, do you accept that there's no mischief in updating this date to the operative date of PC1?
Can you explain what you mean by mischief?
Well, no unlawful activities will be made lawful by updating this date.
Rather than mischief, Council, wouldn't it be better to frame it in terms of whether or not that would be consistent with or contrary to the objectives and policies of the plan change? That's what the mischief is. So is it consistent with what the plan change is seeking to do, or is it contrary to what the plan change is seeking to do, to update the date? Mr. Trevilka.
Yes, so in my view, it's clearly not consistent with what PC1 is seeking to achieve. I mean, the point is, you're right that if you're operating within your certificate of compliance, then you're lawful. But that doesn't mean that activity is acceptable in terms of either Rule 3149 or the objectives of PC1. As you well know, the certificates of compliance are subject to Section 20A2 of the Act, which basically provides only temporary protection until there is a rule under which consent's required. So what you're saying is, if you have changed the land use, shouldn't you be allowed to continue that change to land use by updating the date of the 3147 and I was out 3149, and I would say no, you would have to test that change to land use against the Section 104D principles, so that we know that changed land use isn't going to compromise the achievement of the objectives.
So you're firmly of the view that non-complying activity consent needs to be applied for the lawful conversion that's occurred since 2016.
The lawful conversion under the COC, yes.
Right. And in that scenario, given that the farming operation will be captured by the other rules in the plan, what exactly are you assessing under this rule?
So you're assessing whether the change in land use would be consistent with the objectives of the plan. The whole thing with all the other rules is that they are effectively authorising existing land use. There's only one rule that requires an assessment of an application to change land use, and that's 3149. That is the one that needs to consider if significant land use change, significant I determined as the description in 311.49. And so that is the activity that could have quite significant implications for the achievement of the objectives. All the other activities that are dealt with in the other rules don't have that same risk because they are existing activities and are quite tightly tied down, I think, in PC1 rules not to change in a way that would significantly increase discharges of contaminants.
Okay. And so, unless the farming is permitted, there will be consent applications to farm across the estate.
Yes.
And a separate non-complying activity for that farm to exist.
A separate non-complying activity to test any land use change that has occurred.
Right. We'll come to the efficiency of that later then. So in terms of that scale of change, the rule is 4.1 hectares within the property. Can you open Appendix 1 to Mr. Treasler's evidence?
Can you provide me reference, please?
So in the bundle.
It's volume, the one headed light blue, 308, 309, 310. It's one of the half folders. Mm-hmm. Over the far right. Mr. Treasler's evidence seems to be under tab 1. Starts at 308.0001.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. And the relevant page is 308.0020.
Yes, thank you.
Now, the area in green is Wairakei Estate. And I think you're aware that WPL views it as one property.
Yes.
Now, if we go to the definition of property in Plan Change 1, right, we have things open at the same time. It's on page 78 of the latest council version. So looking at Mr. Treasler's appendix, it's clearly all adjacent land.
Yes.
You're aware it's in common ownership, and it's only separated by roads and rivers.
So I'm not clear about the ownership. You're saying that Wairakei Council owns all that land?
Yes.
Right.
Were you not aware of that?
Not in any detail, no.
Okay. So it's adjacent, it's in common ownership, separated only by roads and rivers?
Yes.
Now, if we look at the definition of property, it has at the end, and is a single operating unit for the purpose of management.
Yes.
Now that's been in there since the decisions version, which doesn't have a definition of single operating unit.
Yes.
Now, you've proposed to add one, which we can see later on the page, which is in response, as I understand, to the Federated Farmers Appeal.
Yes.
But given the reference in the definition of property to and as a single operating unit for the purpose of management, can I check, do you now need to meet both the definition of single operating unit and the rest of the definition of property in order to be a property?
Yes.
And so it was your clear intention not to delete those words from the end of the definition of property?
Yes, I think it's true.
Have you considered deleting those words from the end of the definition of property?
So I'm just trying to think back to when we had these whole conversations. Yes, I think I did consider that.
You think you did?
Yes.
Okay.
I mean, yes.
Hello, go for it.
Well, I was just going to say that the issue we were trying to address at the time wasn't really a Wairarapa pastoral issue. It was an issue where farmers were concerned that if they had a home farm and they had a runoff a couple of k's down the road and perhaps a couple of other properties, they couldn't farm those as a unit or get a consent for those as a unit. So that was the real purpose of it.
Of the new definition.
Yes, but as you'd be aware, we've also had a lot of discussions around this idea of one consent for what are effectively a lot of individual and quite independent in terms of management farming activities, which was more akin to the enterprise approach. And the panel made it very clear they didn't support management of farming using that kind of enterprise approach.
In multiple locations?
Well, whether or not it's in multiple locations, the kind of issues that they were identifying, from my understanding anyway, not necessarily the issue of multiple locations, it's the issue of if you've got one consent for like many dairy farms, whether or not they're next to each other, that can be quite difficult from a regulatory point of view to keep track of the provisions in that consent when there's lots of different people managing different farms. There is a reference I'd like to find if I can, and it may not be necessary from your point of view, where in the decision the panel talked about its concerns about one consent for multiple farms, and in the sense of being multiple dairy farms, for example, that are independently managed. So, I mean, I can find that reference for you. It might take me a little bit of time.
It's not necessary for my purposes.
Yeah, thank you.
You've introduced this single operating unit to address the concerns that a number of farmers raised during the process, where their land is not contiguous, but is run as a single enterprise.
Yes.
And we now have this new definition of single operating unit. My question was, had you specifically turned your mind to how the definition of property now works if the reference to and as a single operating unit is retained in that definition?
Yes, and I have. And like I say, that to me is still consistent with the concerns of the decision of the hearing panel and consistent with the way they were thinking about how farming should be managed, what's the right kind of unit, minimum unit, in terms of a regulatory management process for farming. So I think it's still consistent with that.
Okay. So in WPL's appeal, it seeks to delete that phrase from the end of the definition.
Right.
Now, you didn't address that in your evidence in chief.
Yes.
And I understand that because you focused on the amendments you were supporting rather than the requests that you didn't like. Ms. Dines, in her evidence, put forward two options. One was to delete that phrase from the definition of property, and then she put another forward that she thought might address the concerns of others. Now, in your rebuttal, you deal with this in paragraph 388. And as I read this paragraph, you're only responding to her alternative option.
That may be the case, yes. I know there are a number of things that I didn't respond to in my rebuttal evidence. So that doesn't indicate acceptance necessarily, it just is that I didn't address that.
So did you not feel as the council planner that it was important to respond to everybody's requests?
Given the amount of time available to do the rebuttal, and the large number of 12-hour days it took to do just this much, I covered as much as I could.
Did you cover everything that you were opposed to?
I would have covered most, but I can't guarantee I covered everything. Sorry.
Okay. And so your written evidence is silent on the request to delete this phrase from the definition of property, and you're opposed to that request?
Yes, I am. I still think it works well how it is in terms of both those small properties and the large enterprises with multiple dairy farming and other farming units. I still think that makes sense from a regulatory point of view.
Okay. So, with your new definition of single operating unit, is it now the case that there can only be one milking platform per property?
That's right.
Okay. And so, for example, on Wairaka Estate that has 20 milking platforms, it is at minimum 20 properties.
Yes.
And when you add in other types of farming, you just get more and more properties on the estate.
Yes, it's probably a large number.
What was that, sorry?
There's probably a large number of properties based on these definitions in the Wairaka Pastoral Estate, yes.
Okay, but you haven't attempted to quantify how many properties your new approach would create on
the
estate?
No, I haven't.
Okay. And then for the purposes of the non-complying rule, it's on, let's say, however many properties it ends up being, any of those that have 4.1 hectares, but not the rest.
Sorry, could you repeat that question?
Sorry. If there's been 4.1 hectares of change on one or more of those properties, they require the non-compliant consent under your version of the rule.
What I need to do is refresh my memory about the wording of 11.49 and whether that talks at the proper scale.
It does.
It does, okay. So that would be the case, yes.
So if we look then at how people assume, take a round number of 30, which may be conservative or might not be, for Wairakei Estate to be a property, if we look at how property and single operating unit are used in the rules, so starting at 3.11.4.1, oh, just while I'm on that one, can I check something you said to Mr. Matheson yesterday? Suggested that this rule only applied to properties under 20 hectares?
3.11.4.1?
Yes.
It applies to properties under 20 hectares or properties larger than 20 hectares that are largely equine or poultry farms.
Right. So as soon as you're over 20 hectares, you can only fit under this rule if you're only free range poultry, or you've got 75% stock units and horses.
That was the intention of the rewriting of that through the rebuttal evidence, yes.
Okay. So this rule used to have a condition that the farming occur on one property, which is at 6,
yes.
And you're proposing to delete that? Yep.
Proposing to delete and that with other changes so that...
Sure.
So that there's no averaging across properties.
Sure. And then at 11.4.3, similarly, it used to be condition 5, and you proposed to delete that?
Yes, again, with other changes to make sure that there couldn't be averaging of effects across properties.
Mm-hmm. Across or within?
Across different properties. So I think, I mean, the issue, I think, and this was a while ago again, to try and remember this. So we added in both cases...
that the minimum standards have to be met on the property.
On the property, that's right. So just to make it clear that if you had several permitted activity properties, you couldn't be averaging out the adverse effects across those, across your permitted activity properties. My understanding, that was the reason originally for the clauses that said that the land use is only on one property. So, and there were a lot of people that were against that condition. So, as far as I could see, the only reason you'd have that condition in there was to ensure that if you had multiple permit activities, you couldn't average out effects on cross different properties. So. We deleted that condition and added the words on the property wherever it was necessary in terms of limits.
Right. And then for the controlled activity rule, 3.11.4.4, you've retained it there. So the use of land, this is condition 5,
yes.
The use of land occurs on one property or more than one property within a single operating unit.
That's right.
And then in 11.4.6, which is the RPA rule for the Whangarino wetlands, we've got the same condition there in condition 4.
Yes.
And similarly in 7A, which is your new RDA rule, condition 5 has the same, either on one property or more than one property within a single operating unit. So then over in Rule 3.11.4.7, you default to discretionary as soon as you're farming on more than one property.
Can you tell me where you're reading that? Sorry, I'm just...
I think she means it's a consequence of all the previous rules having
yes.
Condition 5.
Yes.
And it's Rule 7 then that is the wrap-up for farming not otherwise regulated.
serve, I would have assumed, and could have been an oversight, that 3.7 should also be about a property or a single operating unit. But I'd have to think that through a little more carefully.
Isn't though the point, Mr. Trebilco, that if someone doesn't come under one of the other rules because
yes.
It's not a single property,
yes.
They have to be, you want, in this structure,
yes, you're quite right,
they need to be caught by another rule, and then it's a discretionary assessment about how the multiple milking platforms are handled, or the multiple, whatever other multiple there may be in the property.
Yes, you're quite right. Thank you.
Sorry, I'm just trying to work through the framework,
no,
Mr. Brothers.
And I think you might have just had a momentary lapse there, Mr. Trebilco, because I'm fairly confident that you expected farming on more than one property to squarely fit within this rule.
Yes, you're quite right.
Because it's this rule that if you're farming on more than one property, you still need to meet the minimum standards in Schedule C, and you still need a farm plan in accordance with Schedule D2.
I think we were I remembered that we had changed that reference to Schedule C. But maybe I'm wrong there. Right, so we've still got the tailored solution to the stock exclusion. No, that's right. Thank you.
Yes. So yesterday, in answers to Mr. Minhinnock, you suggested that you might give some further thought to deleting these conditions. But I wasn't sure if that's what you actually... Well, you may have reflected on that overnight as to whether you feel there's merit in retaining the Schedule C requirements and the farm plan requirements if farming on more than one property is squarely within this rule.
Could you repeat that again? Sorry.
I'll make it shorter.
Thank you.
Yesterday, in questioning to Mr. Minhinnock, you suggested that these conditions could be deleted, given it's a discretionary activity rule.
Yes.
Have you reflected on that overnight?
I haven't reflected further. My position is written in my rebuttal evidence. I don't really have a strong view, personally, on whether those conditions should stay there or not. I've suggested in my rebuttal evidence that that they're useful, but I've suggested that they're useful in the sense that if a farm is being assessed in accordance with 3.11.4.7, it does give a list of matters that would be considered anyway, whether they are set there or not. It does kind of give some useful guidance for the expectations for a consent officer who's assessing a discretionary activity rule under this. But I don't have a strong view on it, personally. What I think I said yesterday was I wasn't sure what the downside of having them in there was. But if there is a clear downside, then they should be removed.
Dogs, is that right?
Yeah.
Yes, I've heard dogs.
Okay, you might just pause there. Can you hear clearly, Ms. Carruthers?
I can now. Thank you.
Do we think that the interruption is over?
Yes. Yep, should be.
Very good. All right. Now, did you want to finish what you were saying, Mr. Carruthers?
Yes.
Thank you.
I don't have a clear view whether they should be there or not. It's probably like I say, they provide some useful guidance for a consent officer for any application under 3147. Do they create a big problem? Probably the more I think about it, the more I think there could be problems as a result of having those conditions in there. One of the really tricky things that one of our implementation teams suggested the other day was that if a farm can't meet those conditions and becomes a nominate under the rule, at the moment this rule is a hybrid rule, discharge land use. What happens if you go to the nominate rule, which is a discretionary rule, which I understand is for the discharges, not necessarily the land use. So I haven't thought this through in any clear way. But so there may be a number of unforeseen additional complications if we leave those conditions in there. So I'm kind of sitting on the fence, I guess you could say, right now.
But if you took them out, Mr. Trevorrow, wouldn't you then be providing as a discretionary activity for someone to apply for consent across more than one property, and that would mean that they didn't need to meet either the minimum standards or have a farm plan?
I guess that's the concern, but I would say there's nothing stopping council from, even if those conditions aren't there, from applying those requirements. So I'm pretty sure that council, even if those conditions weren't there, if they were going to grant an application for a discretionary activity under that rule, they would more than likely still require a farm plan and so on.
As a condition?
Yes.
Okay. Right. So, we then flip back to the decision, so the independent panel decision. Two paragraphs in particular. Firstly, 187, which is on page 501-1835.
Yes.
Says the evidence for WPL in particular showed what well-directed corporate farming could do with extensive planted riparian margins, engineered design sediment traps and the like.
Yes.
And then down at 1108, which is on 2027.
Yes.
Where it's talking about which farms would fit into the permitted range. Halfway down, dairy farms in this category will likely either be organic, system one and two farms, or farms like WPL that have highly developed farm systems incorporating effective mitigation measures.
Yes.
Do you expect that the decision anticipated that Wairaki Estate would be a permitted activity?
It seemed to indicate that, that's right.
So there's no suggestion that Wairaki Estate wasn't intended to be a property in the decision?
I think that's a different issue, personally. I think what they were saying was that...
Well, to be a permitted activity, you needed to be a property. One property.
You can have lots of individual permitted activity properties without consent.
Oh, I see. Right. So 30-odd permitted activity properties rather than one property.
That's possible, yes.
Okay. for now. In terms of the rule gateways, Mr. Matteson spoke to you about Rule 3.11.4.2 yesterday, which is this rule that applies in the interim and gives permitted activity status until the application date.
Yes.
And he asked you some questions around needing to meet Schedule C immediately and put to you that it might be some other clauses. Now, you may have overlooked at the time, but in Schedule C itself, Clause 4, provides 2 years to implement the stock exclusion rather than immediately. Is that your understanding?
Yes, that's right.
Okay. So provided that's in place within the 2 year time frame, then everybody stays permitted, not stays, but is permitted under 3.11.4.2 until their time comes in the table.
Yes.
And those applications are effectively staggered over a 5 year period due to the resourcing constraints both in the industry and council.
Yes.
And then in the decisions version of the rules, effectively low intensity activity were permitted, moderate intensity were controlled, and high intensity were discretionary, which is now proposed to become restricted discretionary.
Yes.
And Schedule B was used to calculate the intensity, whether you were low, moderate, or high.
Apart from dry stock, yes.
Yes, sorry, apart from dry stock. And so Schedule B's got a little bit messy in this document, so I'd rather use the decisions version one of it, which is in, I don't know what colour the folder is, but it's the 101 series.
Yellow.
I've got a version of that, a hard copy.
We turn to Schedule B in the decisions version. There are three ways of calculating the nitrogen leaching loss rate, which then determines your intensity. So first of all, we had a pre-assigned NLLR.
Yes.
Second option was to use Overseer.
Yes.
And the third option was to use an alternative approved model.
Yes.
And that third option was added in the council level decision on plan change one.
Yes, I think that's right.
Right. So if we go to the relevant parts of the decision. So this is that document 501, line 786 again. The relevant discussion starts at paragraph 591.
Yes.
Which paragraph again, Council?
591. Thank you, sir. Well, really 590, where it explains that this is talking about concerns that Overseer should not be the sole model and that others should be enabled. 591 references Mr. Ford's evidence that Overseer shouldn't be the sole decision support tool. 592 sets out the evidence from Mr. Ford on behalf of Wairakei and Hawkins Head. Both were questioning the use of Overseer in this context.
Yes.
We go down to the 603.
Can I just clarify? Is Mr. Ford talking about the use of overseer for a threshold for the rule, or is he talking about the use of overseer for general management of farming?
The former.
I don't see where he said that.
Oh, I'm sure that's questions that Mr. Conway can put to Mr. Ford week after next.
Thank you.
Well, just so that we are clear, Mr. Trevilco, I just note in 591 there's a quote from Mr. Ford's evidence before the commissioners. The overseer model is not appropriate as the sole, in brackets, decision support tool.
Yes.
So I would have thought that as a decision support tool, that's going to its regulatory purpose rather than its farm management purpose.
I don't read it that way. A decision support tool is, in my view, is a tool used by farmers to understand the implications of changing farm practice in different ways. And so it helps them understand if they change farming in different ways, are they likely to increase or decrease their leaching of contaminants? That's how I understand that, which is very different to using at all as a threshold in the rule.
Thank you.
Down at 603. While we agree overseer may be appropriate in some circumstances, we agree with submitters that overseer is not the appropriate sole decision support tool for use under Plan Change 1.
Yes.
The panel's view it's more effective and efficient to allow the adoption of a suite of more inclusive and complete alternative decision support tools than to prescribe the use of overseer.
Yes, and I agree with that.
And then in 604, there's specific reference to WPL's tool, the Ruahuai decision support tool.
Yes.
And we've got the discussion in 605 to 607. Where the panel determined enabling alternative models, as well as providing for some farming activities based on stocking rates. And that's the reference to dry stock there.
Whereabouts are you reading that?
Oh, sorry, I was just summarising 607.
Okay.
And so then for Wairaki's tool, is discussed in more detail down in 681.
I'm sorry, 681?
Mm-hmm. Wairaki's potential alternative based on vulnerability had considerable merit. The problem with it, however, is that Mr. Williamson's modelling domain is limited in scale. It covers part of the upper Waikato FMU only, and it's too general to be applied across the catchment.
Yes.
Then 682 is a reference to the 750,000 spent by that stage on the model, which was where they were considering whether it could be expanded out to address the entire catchment.
Yes.
And at 683, that this model offers promise for the future.
Yes.
But it wouldn't be appropriate to commit the council to that expenditure. So instead, the panel amended Schedule B to enable its use. And that's where...
Well, it does say in paragraph 683. So it does say in 683 that the model offers a promise for the future, but it's not an option we can use as the basis for an allocation regime in prison.
Across the entire catchment.
Yeah.
But they then added, in Schedule B-A-3 to enable its use on the estate?
Not specifically that model. They added an ability to use an alternative proof model.
Yes, which would include that model and potentially others.
If it can meet those conditions under 3A, B, C, and so on.
Indeed. Now, in your version of Schedule B, you've completely deleted that.
Yes.
Were there any appeals seeking to delete that?
To delete which? The whole of Schedule
B. A3. The use of Wairakei's model on its land.
As a tool for determining the threshold, are you saying that? Were there appeals to explicitly say you couldn't use the Wairakei pastoral model as a tool for the threshold?
Were there any appeals seeking to delete A3 in Schedule B?
I would have to check, I'm sorry, about that. I know there were certainly concerns about it. But I can't remember if there were explicit appeals requesting that removal.
Okay. So the only evidence you've given on the removal, at least that I can find, is one paragraph in your rebuttal 316. As far as I can tell, you're just saying I thought it might be difficult.
I mean, we're here talking about my view of overseer in general, first of all, and it's on that
yes,
basis.
I'm talking about.
Yes, I understand.
I'm talking about.
I understand. So, I'm saying that using overseer for the basis of thresholds should be deleted. That's my starting point.
We'll get to that. Mm-hmm.
And so, because the alternative model says that it needs to be able to produce comparable modelling results or outputs to those of overseer in Schedule B, A, 3B, third bullet point, then mm-hmm. If I'm not supporting the use of overseer, then I couldn't support the use of alternative models that produce comparable results to overseer. It doesn't make sense for me to do that.
I see. So it's collateral damage.
Yeah, I guess you'd say that.
I see. So when you say, I have always thought that it would be a very difficult test, the
yes.
use of an alternative model, that's not your reason for deleting it.
No,
it's
not
because
at all.
You've deleted
it. Not at all. That was just an observation.
Just an observation. Okay. And that's the full extent of your analysis of this change you're proposing.
Yes, I guess you could say that.
Okay. Sir, I'm about to change topics. Would now be a convenient time for the morning?
Yes, now is a good time. Thank you, Mr. Brothers. How much longer do you think you may be now?
Maybe half an hour, sir?